Greetings to each one of you this evening, again, in the name of Jesus. Trust that you found your hearts at peace today and could see God's hand at work in your life. It's not often that I stand behind the pulpit and give a book report, unless we're talking about the Bible, but I've been listening to a book as I traveled recently in the South. It was actually at Darbin at our conference a few weeks ago. Someone referenced a book, and it piqued my interest, The Boys in the Boat. I don't know how many of you have read that book. Some of you, I see looks of recognition, was asking Brother Dwayne about it this evening. He remembered it, and we discussed it just a little bit, and I'm going to condense this down. I think on Audible, it's about 14 hours of listening, and I haven't quite got to the end yet. I listened to a lot of it on the way up here, actually. I haven't quite got to the end, but I had a little spoiler. I know what happens, but I'm just going to hit a few of the points, and maybe you'll remember this if you read the book, and if you didn't, I'll try to make it to where you at least get a grasp on the main theme, and then I'll tell you what stood out to me. So, The Boys in the Boat is a story of a boy named Joe who, he lost his mother at a very, very young age, and his father really reacted to that. I'm sorry, I should have said the setting was back in the I guess it would have been the early, would have been the late 20s at that point, early 30s in that time period. Probably would have been the early 30s. Anyway, he lost his mother, and his father really reacted to that and moved off, left him behind in the care of his aunt, and he faced a lot of hardships. He was moved around from time to time, and through the course of events, his father came back, remarried. He moved in with them and was living under their roof again until things went didn't go well with his stepmother. And at a very young age, I don't remember. Did anybody remember? Was it 10 or 12 when he was left alone at home, and his father told him his stepmother just doesn't want him along. They're going to they need to go on to find work. They can't make it anymore, and they left him there at the house by himself. He stood there and watched him drive away. And Joe made a decision at that moment that he would never put himself in a position where he needed to rely on someone in life again. Not that he would not be a hermit and just clam up and not relate to people, but he would never let himself be dependent on someone else for his survival. And through various means of ingenuity and so on, he eked out a living, and through, there were some devious ways, but he managed to eke out a living and became a very tough young man. And through some help from his brother and all, he was actually able to enter a college in Seattle, Washington. He joined the rowing team there because it was one of his ways to be able to get his way through college. It was very, very important to him to be on the rowing team. They used these real light shells, just racing shells that were, you barely call boats, really, and they're made up of a team of 8 rowers and another man that gives direction. What do they call him? The coxswain, I believe. Anyway, there was a lot of people that applied, wanted to be on the rowing team, but a lot of them didn't make it. They weren't physically tough enough. But Joe did. He succeeded. He was certainly tough enough. He was no stranger to pain and suffering and aching muscles and being out in the freezing rain and cold winds, whatever, rowing. But there was something that was troubling to the coach. I'm just hitting points in the story, okay? You get that. But there was something that was troubling to the coach, and that was that when the team went well, it went really well. They could beat the other teams by a large margin sometimes. But when it didn't go well, it went really bad. And oftentimes they lost by a margin that shouldn't have happened. When they'd be out practicing, there were times when it just didn't go well. And he was nearly at the end of himself, after several competitions and races, wondering, he knew he had the talent there in the young man. He had seen it, but it didn't always go well. And he never knew when was going to be a good day and when was going to be a bad day. And to sum it all up, he asked an older man there for some advice. He said, "Please look at my boys and tell me what's going wrong." It was actually a boat builder, knew a lot about the sport of rowing. And he got to know Joe and observed him and taught him a few things about life. And it really boiled down, Joe's problem at least boiled down to, this older man told him that your problem is that when you go out on the boat, you row furiously, but the problem is you act like you're the only one in the boat. You forget about everybody else and keeping in stroke and in perfect. And he taught him, in my own words, that you're going to have to learn to work together. You're going to have to learn to trust these other boys in the boat. And that was a light bulb moment for Joe when he realized how much he already wanted to be a part of them, because he didn't want to have to trust anyone in life, right? Well, it's a tremendous story. It goes on. Joe had to make the decision. Was he going to listen to that or not? And he did. And they went on. A bunch of farm boys and loggers and so on went on to win a gold medal in the Olympics. And I believe it was 1936 in Berlin, Germany. Very intriguing story. Probably refer to Joe a little later on. But before we go any further, let's sing two verses of our theme song, number 276. I think the verses that I'd like to sing this evening would be 1 and 2. Would you lead those, please, Rodney?
Prince of Peace, control my will.
Message this evening, you may open your Bibles to the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 12. Verses 12 through 27 is what we would like to read this evening. If you think that this is a strange topic for a revival sermon, if you think that you've never heard a sermon like this before at revivals, you're not the only one. I don't think I ever have either. But it's what I felt like the Lord wanted me to share this evening. 1 Corinthians 12, verse 12. For as the body is one and hath many members, and all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we are all baptized into the body, whether we be Jews or Gentiles, whether we be bond or free, and have been all made to drink into one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot shall say, because I am not of the hand, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? And if the ear shall say, because I am not the eye, I am not of the body, is it therefore not of the body? If the whole body were an eye, where were the hearing? If the whole were hearing, where were the smelling? But now God hath set the members, every one of them, in the body, as it hath pleased him. And if they were all one member, where were the body? And I want you to stop there for just a minute, and I want you to think about that little verse. It's there for a reason, that Christ, God does not just want a bunch of members that are rowing furiously. It's important that he has a body. And I know that's just a simple thought, but if they were all one member, where were the body? The body is important. Verse 20, but now are they many members, yet but one body. And if the eye and the eye cannot say unto the hand, I have no need of thee, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. Nay, much more those members of the body which seem to be more feeble are necessary. And those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, upon these we bestow more abundant honor. And our uncomely parts have more abundant comeliness. For our comely parts have no need, but God hath tempered the body together, having given more abundant honor to that which lacked. That there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. And whether one member suffer, all the members suffer with it. Or one member be honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now we are the body of Christ and members in particular, or individually. And we'll stop reading there. So this teaching, I want to be careful with, because it's obviously in the context of spiritual gifts and how to appreciate them and how to view them in the context of the body. I don't want to detract from the context here. If we had gone back a few verses, we would have seen that. But in considering how the body of Christ is made up of many members that must work closely and seamlessly together and how it functions, I would like to zoom in this evening on one aspect that is necessary for the body to work together so seamlessly. And there are a number of aspects we could talk about, of course. We could talk about love, we could talk about appreciation, we could talk about submission. But this evening, the title of the message is Building Trust in Congregational Life. Building Trust in Congregational Life. I chose to read the text in 1 Corinthians 12 because I feel like it comes as close to what I felt led to exhort here this evening. I say exhort because I know very, very little about the level of trust that you have here in this congregation. There are marks and there are things that I can observe, and I hope you're okay with that. I don't know what you're going to do about it if you, because I've already observed some things. But I want this to be, again, this evening, I know I mentioned this before in other sermons, but to be a positive message this evening. But it's a somewhat different subject and a little bit difficult for me to approach because I don't find many references, many places that we can turn in the Bible that speak specifically of how to build trust in congregational life. So this evening, bear with me. A lot of what I have to share is my personal experience, my personal observations and gleanings, and what other people have taught me. Now, I believe it to be scriptural, and I would be happy to explain why I think it's scriptural, but we're not going to go back and try to pull together all the scriptures that would build into this, because it would be a week's assignment instead of an evening assignment. And I want to be careful about twisting verses to fit what I'm trying to say. So we probably won't be looking at much more or any more scripture this evening, perhaps. Have you ever had a body member, thinking of your physical body, have you ever had a body member that you couldn't trust completely? I've witnessed it in people already. I remember standing in a group having a conversation when an older man just hit the ground. He just fell to the ground. And he explained to us that his hip would sometimes just give out. He never knew when it was going to happen, but he couldn't trust his hip. Now, I'm only not low 40s. I'm not even mid 40s yet. So I don't know what it's like to have a hip that might just go out on me and not, I don't know exactly how that feels, but security's pretty low, right? You're never sure when that's going to happen. How much can you trust a body member that you don't know if it's going to support you or if it's not? How much does that change of life and how much you think ahead and what you think about and what you, one little member. And there's other things. I remember This is a really, really, really small thing, but I for a while, I had years ago, I had something in my voice. It was a funny sinus cold. I don't know what it was exactly. And I could talk in a normal voice about this loud. But as soon as I tried to talk louder, my voice just left. It just wasn't even a squeak. It just wasn't there. And it was horribly frustrating dealing with customers in a very low tone of voice, never knowing if you went a little higher, if you were going to lose your voice or not. You didn't know where that mark was. And it was hard for somebody that likes to talk a lot. And you have all kinds of other. There's other, you know, people that. Yeah, organs fail sometimes, and people aren't sure. You know, is it going to work or isn't it? That can happen. So how well does the physical body function when trust is low among the members? Of course, then the question begs to be asked, how well does the church body function when trust is low? How well does a congregation, and I realize that we could expand this to be more than just a congregation, but we're thinking in congregational life this evening. How well does Tyrone Mennonite Church, the congregation here, represent Jesus when trust is low among members? Think of the implications. It is very natural for all of us to want to belong to a group of people, to a congregation where we can trust each other. That is very natural. But this evening, there's only one way that we can approach this message or this topic and think about what can I do to build this trust so others can trust me. This evening, the points are so painfully practical, at least to me, that it's probably a little bit inevitable that you'll think of other people. It'll come into your mind, oh, that's him or that's her or whatever. But that's probably a little bit inevitable, but don't dwell on that. I want us to come back and think, but what am I doing? How am I doing in this to not be that person, or not to be judgmental, but to not be that way? What am I doing to help build and maintain a body in which the members do trust each other? It is said that the first thing you analyze when you meet a stranger is this person safe? And you probably don't even do that consciously on a normal basis. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you meet a really rough-looking character, and it's conscious. It's in your mind right here. That's all you're thinking is it safe for me to be around this person? But even in business acquaintances, even in the grocery store, wherever you are, sometimes that happens very, very, very quickly, and sometimes it takes a little bit. That your natural response or natural thought processes are, is this person safe? Now, thankfully, in our churches, we are starting out with a very high level of trust. I want to be clear with that. I am thankful for the level of trust that we have. I did not worry one bit about my safety if someone would be out to hurt me physically when I got here. I didn't spend any time thinking about that. But what's more than that is that I didn't worry whether one of you would try to swindle me out of some money or not. I wasn't worried about that. If I lost my wallet here this evening, I would be a little preoccupied about it, perhaps. I would want my wallet back because it has my license and it has some other important things in it. But I wouldn't be worried about who would find it and whether I would get it back if one of you all would run away with it. In fact, if you found it and gave it back to me, I probably wouldn't even open it to see if my cash is still inside. There's not much in it, okay? Maybe that's part of the reason. But there's a high level of trust that we're starting out with in our churches, and we need to protect that. But I also want to remind you that it's a whole different level of trust where someone's not worried about their wallet and when someone's willing to open up their heart and share it. That takes trust to a whole new level. I had it written down this way, and we kind of already breezed over it, but the level that's needed in a congregation to represent the body of Jesus Christ is much, much, much higher than what's needed for a community to work together. And this level of trust isn't accomplished just by getting together in the same building on Sundays or for a week of revivals. It takes more effort than that. So, what are a few practical points that we can make this evening? Some of these points, I'll just tell you that they're so practical that I'm going to probably address men's side. Well, not probably, I will. But make your own applications over here. I will make this observation also that a congregation where this side of the house hasn't learned to trust each other is not any less disastrous than where this side has not learned to trust each other. Just throw that out there. So you make your own applications to this, please. Number one, and these are just simple, like I said, just you could come up with them all yourself. I just want to remind you of them. Number one is to learn to know each other well. You know each other. You don't have a problem forgetting each other's names. I do because I don't know you near as well as you know each other. But learn to know each other when I say well, I mean on a deeper level than just the weather and so on. Some people you find it easier to relate to than others. Others are much harder. That is natural. That's a given, no matter where you are. Some people will be much easier for you to learn to know well than others. But the level of trust you place in someone is not generally any greater than how well you know that person. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule. Sometimes you trust in a system. I fly in an airplane sometimes and I have no idea who the pilot is. But we'll get to that in a minute, why we trust those people. Think of this on a business level. How much credit do you extend to someone you have no idea who they are and when they're going to leave town? Versus someone that's been paying their bills faithfully for 15 or 20 years. It makes a big, big difference how well you know the person and know their history and know who they are and know what kind of person they are. But there is an obligation right here within these walls to know each other in our own congregations. I'll just use Tyrone here. For me, it's Smithdale. That is superior to knowing people outside of these walls. And even in a small congregation, it seems like it's just a given that we know each other well. I come from a very small congregation. And I'll tell you that it still takes work because knowing each other well doesn't actually come naturally with some personalities. Some are much, much harder to learn to know than others. You might feel like you click better with some than others, and that's not all bad. That is actually okay. But I would throw this out that social media has really challenged this in maintaining meaningful relationships right within the walls of our own congregation. That might be a point over to this side more than this side. I don't know. It can be on both sides. Some people find it very easy to befriend and keep friends 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 miles away, but they don't get along very well with the people that they rub shoulders with every day. It sets up a false sense of relationships. And social media friendships are not all bad. I'm not going to just throw them out and say, just don't communicate with people. But no, they can be really good, especially if you have something in life that pulls you together. Maybe they have a child that suffered from the same thing your child did, or maybe they've gone through some hardships just like you did. That can be good. You can find encouragement from each other. I'm not pushing that all out. But just be careful they don't replace real relationships in the congregation that you're a part of. And I simply want to throw this out too while we're talking about this. The world will never know that you are Jesus' disciples by the way you keep up with people on Facebook or WhatsApp or whatever other platform that's out there. You see the difference? This happens by eating together, by working together, by traveling together, by making sacrifices together, by living life together. And so I simply challenge you that when you meet together or when you're working together or whenever you're in proximity to each other, don't be afraid, no matter who it is, don't be afraid to go deeper than the weather and the thunderstorms last night and are you getting over your cold? Learn to know each other well. Learn what interests other people. And this takes work, but cultivate a genuine interest in other people's lives. You're not going to learn to know each other well without cultivating a genuine interest. What does make that brother tick? Why don't I find common ground with him? Sisters, same way. Don't put it on. If you don't have a genuine interest in their life, go home and figure out why you don't and cultivate a genuine interest in their lives. Well, we need to keep moving on. I usually tell you how many points I have, but I didn't want to discourage you this evening. It's 8 of them. We'll try to move through them rather rapidly. Number 2, learn to communicate effectively. So this just builds right on the point we just talked about, but learn the art of effective communication would be the other way of saying this, but I tried to keep it short. Learn to communicate effectively. Some people have the tendency to say nothing at all. I'll use brothers' meeting for an example. You get together for a brothers' meeting, and thankfully I don't know any of y'all so how you do in brothers' meeting. I can assume a few things, but some people have the tendency to sit through a whole brothers' meeting and not say a word. And yet you know when they get home, they're going to have plenty to say. And others will sit there and don't care about who's there. They just speak all their minds and forget that there might be other opinions in the room. Both are really, really, really hard to build trust with. Learn the art of effective communication. Y'all make your own applications to that. It might be sewing circle. I don't know. I don't know where this might happen. Remember that listening to learn is every bit as much a part of communication as speaking. Now, this needs to be tempered because some people excel in the art of listening, but remember it has to be listening to learn, not listening to fume and fuss about it later. Have you ever, well, let me hold that thought for just a minute. So, it's equally hard to build trust in someone who doesn't care about other people's feelings and just speaks all his mind without thought, and a brother who won't speak until later. And where do you fit into that? Are you carefully listening and weighing words? And even when it's tough, you have to understand that good communication doesn't mean you just clench your teeth shut when it's hard to talk. No, actually, good communication means sometimes when you feel the least like talking, you should actually express how you feel. And other times when you feel the most like talking, you ought to just be quiet for a bit and listen. Okay? And so we need to learn the art of that. One-on-one communication is also very important. Others need to feel that they are heard and considered valuable even when I disagree with them. There is nothing... Oh, that's a strong statement. It is very frustrating to be talking to someone who, while you're speaking to them, you can see them forming that, like, they can't, you know, they're ready with their rebuttal. You know you're not being heard, right? And how much trust can be built in a relationship with them. And it's good to remember that just listening to learn, and there's a respectful way of telling people, I don't agree with that. You don't have to say, oh, yeah, that's right. But you can tell them, I don't agree with that, but I value your input into my life. I value, but on that area, we disagree. This is how I see it. And you may be able to leave it at that. And it is true that some people refuse to trust you if you don't agree with them in every little matter. And that's something you can't do a lot about, but you don't have to be that person, okay? You can build trust with others even if you don't see eye to eye on every little thing. Number 3, in building trust, keep confidential what is shared confidentially. I guess this is a safe question to ask because I don't have anybody in mind here. I don't know you. But is there anybody in your congregation who everyone knows not to open up and say anything around because it'll get spread around? I don't know, but don't be that person giving into the urge once to share what you know about someone else for any reason will destroy confidence that takes years to build. When you know it was shared confidentially, it will take a long time to get back to that point again. Ask before you decide it's just okay to share what someone was talking to you about. People are made up differently. Some people don't care. If everybody knows that they're considering an occupation change, or they're considering moving to a different area, or they're considering a different job, some people are like open books. They don't care what other people know. And other people are very reserved. And if you have any idea whatsoever, or if you have any question whatsoever, is what I meant to say, make sure you know if that person's okay with you sharing what they told you. I remember a phone call I had. It wasn't even a phone call. It was an in-person conversation, and I thought it would be helpful if we were dealing with something else, and I thought, well, maybe the people ought to know that this brother was considering this, but before I said something, I thought, well, maybe just in case, I better check with him, and I found out very quickly, his feelings were, don't you dare tell other people about that. That's something we want kept quiet for now. That's one time I got it right. I can tell you about a lot of times I got it wrong. But I realized that would have destroyed a lot of trust. He wouldn't have ever felt like opening up to me again like that. There's people like that in your life. I only give a personal example because I don't know the personal examples that you have, because I guess that you kept quiet about them probably. God bless you for that. So keep confidential what is shared confidentially. Number four is to accurately represent others. Accurately represent others. In other words, be really careful that you don't twist what other people say or do. We all know that you can say the exact same words another person has said and leave a total different impression. That's one way of doing it. Be careful in the way that you represent others and what they said. And this is especially important to remember when there are different viewpoints or when there's stress of some sort in congregations or in church groups. In fact, as I observe, I really wonder on this point right here, if some church divisions, some people being disillusioned and moving away from congregations and so on, could have been avoided if only this point here was put into place, where people just accurately represented what other people were saying and feeling and thinking. It's a heavy point. Of course, it goes hand in hand with the other ones. It usually doesn't stand by itself. Number five, uphold brotherhood agreements and practices. Uphold brotherhood agreements and practices to the best of your ability and to the best of your understanding. Even if you disagree with it being the best decision that could have been made, or even if you leave a meeting and you have a light bulb moment and say, this would be a much better way of doing things. Some personalities are tend towards that way. I know I can be that way, kind of fly by night and get together and discuss something and wake up the next morning and say, here's the real answer. Breaks trust down very, very quickly. That point was brought to mind probably mostly from the book A Good Minister. I talked about that in there. Uphold brotherhood agreements and practices. This point is probably especially to you as men, as you are given responsibility in church. That's where it's at least the most obvious and can be the most dangerous. Just because you are the school board chairman or the head trustee or the Sunday school superintendent or the preacher, or we even have a bishop here, he's the only one that gets to go off on a limb by himself, right? No. When there's agreement and there's practice, there's agreements and practices, we hold those up. And when a brotherhood agreement or a standard is made, it is our responsibility to uphold it, whether it's like we think it's perfect or not. There's not many ways of breaking down trust faster than agreeing to something when you're together and then administrating differently. It seldom builds trust to yank people out of their traditions without much thought and discussion. And what I mean by that is, so let's just use Sunday school superintendent, for example. You've been given the job of Sunday school superintendent. You go home and you think of much better ways that we could do Sunday school, and you have these visions that you would like to just put into practice this Sunday school year. So you come here and that's the way you administrate. it's pretty hard to build trust in people that just administrate their grand ideas when there's been a way for years that things have been done. I'm not saying you can't ask for improvement or bring up other ideas. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying to go make radical changes that jerk people outside of their comfort zone is never a good way to build trust. That's all I'm saying. Just because you can't find a standard or decree or a letter somewhere that spells something out specifically how we do things doesn't mean it's a good idea to just start administrating differently. In other words, in summary on that point, honor traditions and practices. And if change is needed, discuss that and move forward carefully. Number six is be real and allow others to be real. Be real and allow others to be real. So this point is sort of intertwined in some of the other points. I'm not sure. I want to make myself clear on it, but I don't want to overdo it if we already talked about some of these things. But I know of several situations where individuals shared their heart and thought they were being heard and considered and understood, only to be scolded and ostracized and belittled because of the struggles they shared. We need to be real with who we really are and what we struggle with and allow other people to do the same. And just because you know the brother two benches behind you is struggling with something that you simply can't understand doesn't make him weird or more or less valuable than what you are. It is so easy. I think this applies to, in some ways, I think it applies a little differently on both sides of the house, but on this side of the house versus this side of the house. But we tend to be very hard on the areas we have mastered and very lenient on the areas that we don't have mastered. I don't know if we have any areas mastered. But anyway, we have to be real. Creating an environment, and by the way, this isn't a preacher point, this is an everybody point. Creating a church group, an environment where we pretend we are all perfect, does not build trust, it builds hypocrites. We have to have the trust where we can open our hearts and be real when we get together. Now, of course, we expect other people to be growing. We don't just promote the modern day idea that we just accept people just like they are as long as they claim to be have a relationship with Jesus. No. But people have to know they'll be heard, and if not understood, at least not ostracized for the way they're struggling. Allow them to be real and be real about your own struggles. Number seven, willingly accept and embrace accountability. We, as conservative Anabaptist churches, have been given a tremendous blessing that I am afraid I see too often. It is very much disdained. Willingly accept and embrace the blessing that we have of accountability, of a group of people keeping you accountable, that's willing to ask you about your life, that's willing to challenge you on your use of technology, that's willing to ask if what they heard about you is actually true. All those things go down so hard. I don't like them either, but it's a tremendous blessing that we have. Let me tell you a little story that happened to me. A number of years ago, we flew, my wife and I and two youngest children, flew to Belize for a week of meetings. And we got to the airport and met someone there I had never seen before and picked him out as a conservative Mennonite man. He picked us out as conservative Mennonites, of course, knew that we were the couple to pick up. And he took us to his home and fed us supper, and we visited, and we had very few connections we knew a few of the same people, but mostly we were complete strangers. Well, Monday night came, Monday evening service came and went. We went back to his house. Monday night, his mother-in-law passed away in the States somewhere. I don't remember where she was from. And so we stayed Tuesday evening yet. Wednesday morning, they flew out to go to the funeral. And I still remember. I can't forget. When we went to leave there for the airport, he said, "Here's the keys to the pickup truck. I filled it with gas. It should be plenty till we get back. Here's the keys to the house. Here's where we keep our extra money in case there's any need for anything. We're going to let you stay in our house, and we're going to the States." And it wasn't until it really felt weird. It was when I was on the way back to his house, I thought, this is really strange. Just using someone else's house, knowing where the dish is with the extra money, it's really strange. And it put me on a line of thinking, why did he trust me like that? Did in 2 days I was able to impress him? No, it wasn't that. He would have done the same for any one of y'all. Why? Because there's a super high level of trust in our groups that we already talked about, right? And he knows that being part of a conservative church, you're accountable. And if you're known to go around robbing people blind and stealing their pickup trucks and all, you won't be a part of that church, right? And in part, it's accountability that builds that trust. I talked about getting on an airplane with a pilot. You don't have any idea who he is. But see, what happens is, you know that man didn't just wake up that morning and say, "I'm going to dress up in a white shirt and a tie and I'm going to go fly an airplane today." No, he's accountable to a company, a system that proves he's worthy of flying the airplane. And sometimes you read stories that make you wonder, right? But accountability has been a tremendous blessing to our churches. And I'll just say it this way. I'm jealous that it keeps on being a blessing to our churches and doesn't turn into something that's disdained. You are your brother's keeper. The Bible doesn't use the word accountability, but you know, it does talk about that you are your brother's keeper, but you know what else that means? It means your brother is your keeper. And if accountability goes away, how can we be each other's keepers? You don't have any responsibility without accountability. Does that make sense? Let's keep it alive and well in our congregations. The last point is to be consistent, or I might put the word predictable in there. Doesn't mean that as you grow and as you mature in life and as you face different circumstances in life, you won't change your position on some things. That's not what it means. But it means that the brethren that know you well, the ones that you go to church with, ought to be able to predict pretty closely where you'll come out on a given issue because you're consistent and you're predictable. And that happens when you are it's amazing how words will leave you right when you go to use them. Principle-based is what I mean, is what I meant to say. When you are concerned about principle, you become a person that is predictable. More or less, okay? You might be surprised sometimes at some little things, but when you're principle-based, you become predictable. That is much different than a person that's just worried about, yes, I want to have this technology, but no, that's completely out. And yes, I think we should be able to do this sport, but no, that one's completely out, because they're making decisions based on the way they feel, on their feelings, versus looking at principles and saying, well, if we don't want to do this, then we better not do this either. And if we think this is a good thing, then by nature, this should be good also. I know there's more to it than that, but be principled and therefore be predictable, and that's someone that people can trust. I can think of several examples, good and bad. I can think of people that look like rocks to me, and I trust their judgment even if I don't know a lot about situations. They're principled, and I know that if they made a judgment call, they're human, they can make mistakes, but they probably thought a lot about it, and I know of other people that you don't know which way the judgment's going to fall. One's a lot easier to trust than the other. Of course, there's also the consistency in practicing what we profess. That also builds trust and confidence. To get up and preach one thing and go, or give testimony to one thing, or teach Sunday school and portray one thing and go live a different way will never build trust. It shows you can depend on an individual. He's sound. Well, that was my last point. I simply want to wrap up by reminding us that very naturally, we want everybody else at church to be these kind of people. I do. But just reflect. Think about it. What have you done to make this place a safe place, a place where people trust each other, a place where they don't have to worry whether the hip's going to go out and there's going to be another crash? But we're all the ones in the boat. Are rowing together to the best of their ability, there's a tremendous amount of good that can be accomplished. All honor and glory to God. Well, thank you for your attention again this evening. Continue to pray. I would ask, if you think about it, to pray for my wife and son as they travel tomorrow, my other children as they stay home. They've faced very minor difficulties compared to some of the prayer requests this evening. Last night, there was a tornado went between our house and my place of work and some other very damaging storms, and it looks like it could be a while till they have power and all. I know those are minor things, but if you would pray for my family along with me, I would greatly appreciate that. Let's stand for dismissal.